Back together again, you and I chatting it up once again during Thanksgiving week, Tuesday, November 26, 2024 on Connecticut Today. I open the show with word of a Hearst, Connecticut media investigation into some discrepancies connected to recent Connecticut election results. CBS News correspondent Chris Fox joined us from Austin, Texas, to talk about a visit earlier in the day to the southern U.S. border by incoming White House border czar Tom Holman. We welcome Dr. Robert Marbit, senior producer of a new streaming documentary, Fentanyl Death Incorporated. Yankee Institute blogger Megan Portfolio, of course, she dropped by, as she does every Tuesday, with her weekly update. And we capped off the show with University of New Haven senior lecturer in economics and business, Dr. Brian Marks, explaining all the possible effects of trade tariffs proposed by President-elect Donald Trump. So if you've been listening to me do these kinds of shows here and at previous stations I was at, one of my favorite phrases is, and it can be applied to a bunch of different situations, the math always wins, right? The numbers, you can't have your own math. 2 plus 2 is always 4. 4 plus 4 is always 8. 6 minus 3 is always 3. You know what I mean? These are, you know, you can't dispute. These are mathematical properties. And I always say that the math wins in any sort of election, national, statewide, or local. And the math always wins when we're talking about, things regarding budgets and all that. Well, the math always wins when it comes to elections, too. And another thing I always say, and that is mostly pointed out here in this state by independents and Republicans, a lot of times if Democrats are encountered with, hey, you know, we have to make sure the elections are securely run in this state and there may be discrepancies in the vote, usually the dominant party in Hartford will say, oh, no, come on, you're buying into this Trump nonsense. Come on, you got to be kidding me. Of course, the elections are fair. Well, I guess, but how about this? Many Connecticut state lawmakers, now bipartisan, by the way, many Connecticut state lawmakers and the American Civil Liberties Union in Connecticut, the Connecticut ACLU, hardly a right-wing organization, are all of a sudden, stop the presses, Maud. They're calling for reforms after a Connecticut Insider report on election errors. And kudos to the folks at the CT Insider, ctinsider.com. That's a Hearst publication. Story today, Alex Putterman's story, which posted earlier today, and there was an inkling of this that trickled out last night. All of a sudden now, lawmakers from both parties, as well as the ACLU of Connecticut, are calling for action. Oh, we need action. What's that old high school cheer? Action, action, we want action, ACT, ION. You see, I covered far too many high school football and basketball games, but I digress. Lawmakers from both parties, as well as the ACLU of Connecticut, called for action Monday night in light of a Connecticut Insider report. Again, good for Hearst for doing this on some apparent data errors in certified election results. Now, these are not results from just one night and there's got to be recounts. No, the math doesn't add up, apparently, and it's not in a boatload of elections here. But all Hearst went and did is look at some numbers from 2016 and 2020, and they said, huh? What? Say Representative Gail Mastro-Francesco, the top Republican, the ranking Republican on the General Assembly's Government Administration Elections Committee, said we need to find out what happened and why and when we need to take steps to correct it. The public already does not have trust in the process, and when things like this happen, it makes it even worse. Matt Blumenthal, Richard Blumenthal's son, Stanford Democrat, who co-chairs that committee, said Monday he'll look into potential reforms during the coming legislative session, calling it, quote, vitally important that all election data be reliable and accurate. Matt, I love you, but you know what's going to happen? Going to be members of your party. There's going to be members of the majority party in Hartford that are going to say, well, we can't do this because it'll, you ready? All together now. It'll, ready? Disenfranchise people. They'll whip out the D word. Matt Blumenthal said in an email, quote, I look forward to working with the Secretary of the State's office, elections officials, and my colleagues to review the issues this session and implement any reforms needed to ensure the accuracy of all elections data going forward. Of course, we're going to implement all this stuff until we're not. Because there will be people, I guarantee you, there'll be people, I don't know who it's going to be. I have five or six, you know, prime culprits ready, but I'm not going to say it. We're going to have people say, well, you can't do that with the voting rolls, and you can't do that with checking IDs, and you can't do that, and you can't do that, and no, you can't do that. So what happened all of a sudden, you ask? What shook everything up here? Well, let's present it to you here. And by the way, if you have any thoughts on this, love to hear them from you. At 203-333-9422, especially if you are someone who thinks, oh, this whole election thing that Republicans always cry about, it's this is Trump. These are the MAGA types. Oh, really? After initially noticing some apparent discrepancies in the state's 2024 election results, in other words, the ones we had just a couple of weeks ago, the fine folks at the Connecticut Insider looked through numbers from previous years, discovering at least 10 instances in certified data. That means the data is certified. That means that's what goes in the record books. Instances in certified data from 2016 and 2020 where the number of reported voters did not align with the number of votes tallied. You're kidding me. You mean to tell me the number of votes that are reported to have been certified, as in they are certified by the Secretary of the State's office? You mean that didn't line up with the number of votes? Really? I'm shocked. Oh, my darling, catch me as my head falls to the floor. Bump. I'm shocked. And a kudos to the people at Hearst and the Connecticut Insider. They apparently were going through some past results of elections, municipal elections here in the state, and now everybody is agog on both sides of the aisle, and the ACLU of Connecticut is upset here that Hearst found at least 10 instances in data certified from 2016 to 2020 when the number of reported votes did not align with the votes tallied. In other words, that's like, you know, that's like saying, well, the Yankees beat the Red Sox 9-8, and you say to yourself, well, there's 17 runs scored last night, but they reported 23 votes. Or they reported 15 votes. Yeah, but the final score was 9-8. Well, was it? Here's an example. Does this upset you? Now, this is what I always talk about when, you know, the majority party a lot in Hartford, they poo-poo voter security and say, oh, what's the big, you know, there's always going to be, I've heard this too, no elections are perfect, and there's always going to be a few votes here and there. Yeah, but you know what? That few votes here and there can make a difference. No, it can't, Paul. Oh, yes, it can, honey. Let's go back to 2016, it says here, 8 years ago. In one example, the town of Cheshire said that in 2016, 14,980 people cast ballots. Okay? So that's 14, follow along, comma, 980. Got that? 14,980 people cast ballots in Cheshire in 2016. But on their official results that year, they show 15,421 votes were tallied, meaning the town was listed as having had 441 more votes than voters. Now, here's what I know. If you keep a cash drawer like that and you're at Stop and Shop or ShopRite, or Aldi's, or Big Y or Target or Walmart or any of the big stores, and your drawer, remember that? You know, you got to reconcile the drawer at the beginning and the end of your shift. If it ends up at the way at the end of the at your shift, you're going to get fired. You're going to get fired. So what's the big deal? You say, hey, Paul, what's the big deal? It's 441 votes off. Well, that year in 2016, a state legislative race in a district that includes Cheshire was decided by 85 votes. Oh, look at that. Now, I'm not here to pillory the fine people of Cheshire, anybody up who may have worked the polls in that election, but seriously, what gives? And this is a point I always make. Some of these state House districts and some of these state Senate districts are remarkably close. Remarkably close. And again, that year, a state legislative race in a district that includes Cheshire was decided by only 85 votes. And you wonder why some people don't trust the... Now, look, I know it's tough to get people to work the polls. And a lot of people that work the polling places aren't exactly spry and young. Let's just put that up front here. We know what the deal is here. Registrars and town clerks interviewed said generally that sort of mistake typically owes to human error, as election workers must make manual calculations, often at the end of a long day. Really? Can you use that excuse at a bank? Ah, it was a long... Hey, your teller's draw is off by $212.50. Oh, it's a long day. What do you want from me? Yeah, but the draw's off. So? Discrepancies did not follow any obvious partisan pattern occurring in both Democratic and Republican-leaning towns and cities, and CT Insider found no indication of fraud or intentional manipulation. And nobody's alleging that, honestly. But you can't be off by that much. You can't be off by 441. You just can't. B. Ray Perryman, a spokesperson for the ACLU of Connecticut, said Monday she'd like the state to investigate whether errors in each case affected the results themselves or merely election statistics. She's right. She also called for additional training for local election workers and more state oversight so the task of spotting errors does not fall to news reporters and outside observers. Ms. Perryman is spot on there. What do you think? And look, I know cities and towns love to be their own fiefdoms, but this is not good. Shouldn't the numbers add up? And I don't want to hear anybody say, well, you know, no, I don't want to hear, you know. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. So according to this, from the CT Insider and Hearst, you know, some mathematical slop could have affected a legislative race back in 2016. You okay with that? Look, I know it's tough to get people to work the polls. That's no excuse. The state has to step up here. But I guarantee you there are going to be people in Hartford that are going to say, no, because if we do that, .. They don't want to crack down on the voting rolls because that the D word comes out. Disenfranchisement. Guaranteed. News coming up, traffic and weather together. Henry leads us off. Henry, what's up with you?
Yes, Paulie. You were talking about the numbers?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're right. I don't know why there's a bad connection. Oh no, maybe now it's okay.
Yeah, I got you.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, Connecticut, the governors. Do you remember that around the country, the 50 governors, and it was an anonymous vote, like you just put the name in, mm-hmm, without your name with it.
Yeah,
the 50 governors. And they said, take a vote now. Now that's beginning to end. And when the pandemic started,
yeah,
which Trump was still in office for a year, and all the way till the end. And when you look at everything, education, crime, everything, when you regard everything, our governor got over 40 votes.
Oh, yeah.
And
listen,
you couldn't vote for yourself.
So
everybody in Wyoming, all those red states, you see, when they don't have to admit who they are, when they look at the numbers, they say, look, who did it? Connecticut did it better than everybody.
Well, apparently, Henry, thank you for the call. I got to move on. Thank you. Okay. Hey, listen, we're just trying to fit. Henry, I love you, but we're talking about adding up the spreadsheets in the local elections here. I don't know how Ned Lamont got involved there, or Trump, or whatever. All right. Thank God I'm off tomorrow. In which a lot of big cities here in the state, Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, got together with the Attorney General, William Tong, a few days ago and said, hey, any mass deportation effort by Tom Homan and the incoming Trump White House is going to be met with resistance here in deep blue Connecticut, likely in other states across the country. But in other parts of the country, including Texas, a lot of people may be cheering this. CBS reporter Chris Fox joins us from Austin to talk about that. Hey, Chris, good afternoon. How are you?
Good. Thank you very much. Yeah, one of those that's celebrating it is Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who is with Tom Homan in Eagle Pass today.
Yeah, what happened? So I'm seeing it kind of described, Chris, as maybe a photo op or not. What was the deal?
No, the whole thing could kind of be considered that, in that it was referred to as they'd be meet and greet with National Guard soldiers and the state troopers, and then be feeding them their Thanksgiving dinner.
Uh-huh.
I didn't see any of the feeding part of it.
Okay.
So they weren't lined up at tables, so they will say that. And it was a less informal. It was kind of pitched as a press conference where it was more of like a rally. And Tom Homan taking the microphone from Governor Abbott, talking directly to the soldiers. I think one of the most powerful statements he said was, let me be clear, there is going to be a mass deportation because we just finished a mass illegal immigration. And he opened by saying, and I hope I can get away with saying this.
Yeah.
For the last 4 years, I wake up every morning pissed off about what this administration did to the most secure border in my lifetime. And so that was how he started the whole thing. So it did come across more as a rally. Also, at the same period of time, the optics of Eagle Pass, because Eagle Pass, if you remember, is where Governor Abbott and President Biden had most of their legal battles over border buoys, over concertina wire, over taking over of Shelby Park from the feds, and that all taking place in Eagle Pass. And nearby in Starr County, the state of Texas just purchased 1,400 acres and offered it to the federal government for mass deportation efforts. To build.
Yeah. So Chris, I mean, first of all, Homan, I mean, if politically somebody is in favor of this, and probably half the country is and half the country isn't, whatever. I mean, he is right out of central casting for this whole thing, is he not? I mean, you look at the guy and you say, I don't think he's lying when you look at him.
He's lying to those you mentioned earlier, those who are lining up to fight this in court.
Mm-hmm.
He did have a message for them. Don't cross this line.
And
it was out of central casting.
We've seen
a lot of that here.
Yeah. I mean,
there's been a lot of posturing and picture taking along the border. I'm going to say going back to Governor Perry.
Wow.
Who was the first one I saw. And the first one I saw kind of use it as something to get reelected and use it in a way thumbing its nose at the federal government trying to take over immigration by putting the Texas National Guard on the border, even though the argument is there's really nothing they can do legally.
Yeah, and the odd thing is, Chris, and I've talked about this on my show here, and people say, well, you know, the Republicans and Trump, they scuttle that border deal. Yeah, but that, Chris, indirectly came around again to help Joe Biden, because it forced Joe Biden to sign that executive order, which clamped down on the border even further. And I guess that's why, correct me if I'm wrong, the border crossings recently have gone down big time, right?
Yeah, and both sides are like to take credit on that one, especially in Texas, where Operation Lone Star is the Texas border security effort that grew from $800 million to biennially to last year it was $12 billion.
Wow!
So absolutely massive growth, and you always hear when they up the amount the spent on it that we're going to appeal to the federal government, they're going to pay us back, and that's never happened, nor will it.
Now, Chris,
what is kind of interesting and to keep an eye on is right now in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Senate Bill 4 has been sitting there for about 7 or 8 months at least, and that's the longest I've ever seen. Senate Bill 4 is the one that Texas would basically establish its own immigration system and allow state police to arrest migrants and judges to deport them. And that, would thumb its nose at constitutional law and supremacy clause, definitely.
Sure.
But it is still sitting there, and it's something that Fifth Circuit generally – sides with Texas in a New York minute, if you use a bad phrase, on everything. And in this case, they've been sitting on this appeal for a long time.
So finally,
my thought was they were waiting for the election. And now that it's gone the way it has, it'll be interesting to see if that now gets scuttled or if this is a blueprint for the Trump administration going forward. Because one of the things Tom Holman said today was Texas's Operation Lone Star is a model that they're planning on using across the country. And that's something that I think is one of the biggest statements of the day.
And Chris, finally, you're out of Austin, obviously, and my son's done some work down there. And Austin is kind of the center of what is Blue Texas, for what that's worth. So are there local groups? Are there ACLU chapters? Are there pro-immigration groups who are promising to stand up to this thing versus how it's going over in the rest of the state? What's the temperature of the average Texan down there, if there is such a thing?
It is strangely... It is partisan, but it's less partisan than you'd think in that there are Democrats who are also mad as hell about the border. I'll give you Colin Allred ran against Ted Cruz for Senate this year. And that was kind of his argument was, I don't stand with Biden on the border issue.
Wow.
And so there is when it's your own backyard. it's kind of one of those arguments. And this is the backyard. The other part that's interesting is, I've visited the border several times, whether it was in El Paso or Eagle Pass or Harlingen. And people that I've asked in Texas who I've interviewed, I always say when they bring up immigration as their top issue and border security, if they've ever had any run-ins, anything with migrants.
Sure.
And I've yet to find anyone who said yes.
Really?
But that's kind of a different story. But it is definitely perceived as the issue. Also, Austin kind of used to be, Governor Perry called it the blueberry and the cherry pie of Texas. I kind of think that's now shifted to Harris County and Houston.
Really?
Just because of the sheer size of it.
Yeah.
And if you were talking about the fourth largest city in the country, the third largest school district, it's kind of shifted a little bit to Houston.
Wow.
Although that being said, Williamson County, just outside of Austin, has now kind of shifted blue where it wasn't.
Well, demographics change, right? Right, Chris.
Yeah, most of the large cities, are blue. Suburbs are purple, and then everything else is
red,
bright red,
beet red. Chris Fox, a CBS News correspondent out of Austin, Texas. Hey, Chris, thanks. Have a happy holiday weekend, and we'll chat with you next time. Thanks.
Thank you very much. You too.
Appreciate it. Chris Fox there. As we continue right here on another edition of Connecticut Today, right here on WICC 600 AM and 95.9 FM. Of course, you and I have talked and have read and listened to and watched several news stories concerning the deadly drug fentanyl and the scourge now that it has brought to the United States and other parts of the world as well. There is a streaming documentary that's going to be hitting streaming platforms coming up in a few weeks in January of 2025. It's called Fentanyl Death Incorporated. One of the producers is joining us today and to talk about this and talk about why he felt he had to get involved with this. He is a fentanyl expert who's worked on issues of illicit drugs such as fentanyl and homelessness for over four decades, first as chief of staff to San Antonio Mayor Henry Cisneros. Then he worked in the Bush number 41 White House, as well as other positions. We welcome Dr. Robert Marbot to Connecticut today. Hi, Dr. Marbot. How are you?
Thanks so much for having on. And more importantly, thank you for really bringing awareness to the fentanyl crisis, which is much needed.
Well, having had a friend of mine's stepson fall prey and ultimately lose his life to fentanyl and illicit drugs, Dr. Marbot, it's my pleasure to do this because I think the message has to get out there. Let's start, and I know a lot of people are very smart when it comes to this stuff, but define fentanyl for us, and why is it in the news so much?
Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid that replaced a lot of the organic poppy seed-based opioids. And really in 2014 or so, it starts to take off. And then by 2019, it's at epidemic proportions. And the reason why we got to care so much about this and worry so much about it, work on it, is fentanyl is 100 times more powerful than morphine, 10,000% more powerful than morphine. Two granular equivalent to salt crystals would kill most people. Three will kill everybody. 1/15th of a rice grain equivalent of fentanyl will kill anybody. And so it's incredibly deadly. You can't smell it. You really can't see it. Yeah, you can't taste it. You don't know it's in. It's permeating the overall illicit drug supply. And it has become the most deadly created drug ever in the history of the world.
Now, as
we should care about it.
Yes, I understand it, Dr. Marbot. There are, though, legitimate uses of fentanyl in a controlled medical setting, in hospital settings. Is that where this came from?
Absolutely. And in 1959, it got created. And it's really made a lot of heart surgeries possible, a lot of open heart transplants where people were dying on the table of shock. And so fentanyl, when used medically properly, with two or three doctors monitoring you and watching your heart rate, your blood pressure, your oxygenation, et cetera, it can be a very, very appropriate drug for that. But it is so powerful. And when it's used illicitly, that's when it becomes deadly.
Who is profiting from this illicit use, Dr. Marbot? And I'm sure the documentary goes deeply into this. Where is this coming from? Who can we look at and legitimately point at to say, hey, you've got to stop this because you're doing this on purpose?
Well, it started with Purdue Pharma, the modern day fentanyl crisis in America, a direct tie between Purdue Pharma and the Mexican cartels in China. In essence, the Mexican cartels and bad actors in China filled the void after Purdue Pharma got hundreds of thousands, millions of people addicted. And then suddenly, with all the lawsuits, the script stopped. Doctors stopped prescribing it. Pharmacies started giving it out. Hospitals started regulating the use. But by then, you had all these people addicted. If you remember the story, they were saying fentanyl was non-addictive. And, you know, they had different version and brand names and such. And they said it wasn't addictive. Well, it turns out not only was it not addictive, it was probably the most addictive drug that's ever been created. So the cartels jumped in and said, hey, we got an addicted market. We're ready. Their drug supplies is going away. We're just going to fulfill the void. And that's how it got started. And so it was initially Mexican cartels and China backfilling from the Purdue crisis. And then since then, in the last year in particular, Canada has really come in. The biker gangs in Canada are really starting to pour drugs in from the northern border now.
So these entities, these drug gangs, these people who are purported to be behind this, so they are what, actually cranking out this stuff? Do they have scientists working for them? Do they have drug experts and chemists and high-tech people on their payrolls?
Absolutely. They got bad actors, but none of those. These are people doing it in their back alley, in basements, and out in jungles. And we have some pictures in our documentary, which by the way, you can see now on salemnow.com. And we have pictures of people producing meth and fentanyl together out in the middle of a jungle. And so you don't even know what the dosing is. You don't know how lethal this batch is versus the next batch. It's a crapshoot. Now, if you take anything with fentanyl in it, it's an absolute crapshoot on whether that dose is lethal or the next dose will be lethal.
So, Dr. Marbit, and the guest is Dr. Robert Marbit. He is a producer of the streaming documentary Fentanyl, Death Incorporated, available now on Salem Now and coming to other platforms in January. So, Dr. Marbit, how culpable is China in this? And you mentioned Mexico previously and China. Is this a direct type of attack on the U.S. to weaken the nation? Where does your documentary go with that?
Well, first off, China got it started. You know, after Purdue, China said, we're producing it. We can bring you the finished product over, and we're going to use the Mexican cartels to be our distribution network. And then over time, it found that they could make just as much money doing the precursors, and now they're doing precursors and sending it into Mexico, and then they're doing the production and such. And so you got bad actors in China, bad actors in Mexico, and now bad actors in Canada. Initially, it was clear it was all about money. It was just, let's get some money. And then the China government started going, hold on a second. We're bringing cash flow to our country, and it's really disrupting one of our biggest adversaries. It's pulling at the main fabric of society of America. And China government goes, here's a win-win. I mean, it starts out as money, and now it's like really disruptive to American society. And I spent almost three weeks working in China, going to China, went all over China to prep for the movie and do research. And here's what I know. In China, there's no fentanyl use. There's almost no drug use of any kind in China. They know how to clamp down. Of all 3 weeks of looking, big cities, small cities, back alleys, everywhere, I only saw four people on any sort of, altered state. One was alcohol, one was meth, and two were fentanyl. And you can always tell the fentanyl people because they're bent over. Mm-hmm. Two people in almost 3 weeks looking at tens of thousands of people going everywhere. If you go outside in Philadelphia or outside in San Francisco, your hotel, you'll see 200-300 people on a block in San Francisco. And in all of China, all I saw was two people on fentanyl. That's it. So China knows how to crack down, and they're choosing to crack down on their domestic supply, and they're choosing to allow the international supply to come hit America.
What do we need to do here? What does the U.S. maybe and our allies need to do to crack down on this, maybe just to put our foot down and to say enough is enough? Is that even possible?
It is possible, and I think with the incoming President Trump, he's getting after it. He's already talking what he's going to do, whereas the last 4 years, we've been like a cork bouncing around at sea. So you got to get tough on China. You got to get tough on China, and then you got to go after the Mexican cartels precisely. You got to go after the biker gangs in Canada. And we also have to really talk about the decriminalization movement that has gone all over the United States. And we have to recriminalize high-end drugs. And we have to have hard punishment for wholesale dealers who flood cities with fentanyl. And this idea that you can have harm reduction and decriminalize it, You can't make fentanyl safe. It is the most deadly drug ever known, and it can't ever be taken safely.
Fentanyl expert Dr. Robert Marbot, he is the producer of the documentary Fentanyl, Death Incorporated. Check it out, streaming now on salemnow.com and also on other platforms coming in the next few weeks. Dr. Marbot, good work by you. Congrats on this. I intend to watch it. And continued good luck, and hopefully we can chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much for caring about this issue. Really appreciate it.
Our weekly Tuesday afternoon check-in with Megan Portfolio. She blogs at the Yankee Institute, hence the Hartford Portfolio. Good afternoon, and how are you?
Hey, Paul. How you doing?
You sound like you're on the road.
I am.
Yeah?
Is it terrible?
No, it's not terrible. No, it's fine. Don't know.
Oh, okay. Well,
no.
I don't want to ever let you down.
No. We discussed that in therapy. You never let me down, okay? Don't you remember we went over that? It's a running joke here with me and the morning show host about our work therapy. But I digress. So how are you? You getting all set for Thanksgiving week?
I've officially stopped eating because I need to make room for all the deliciousness on Thursday.
Yes. I like stuffing, and more stuffing. But you have written this week about an office that we hear about, the city and town clerks, but you're asking a few questions about those clerks in every city or town. And I think by state law, there has to be one Republican and one Democratic clerk, correct? Or am I wrong?
Nope, you're 100% correct. It could technically be a third party if they had enough votes, but right now it's one Republican, one Democrat. It's to create, you know, like a sense of fairness,
mm-hmm.
and transparency.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. So what's up with that?
So these registrars in every town, it's actually a very, very important job. They manage everything having to do with the election,
mm-hmm.
From maintaining the voter rolls to the voting machines to training the poll workers. And, you know, like everything else in Connecticut, it's regulated. And per state statute, they're supposed to be certified. Once they take the job after 2 years, they're supposed to get a certification. And then every year after that, they're supposed to get at least 8 hours of training. And, you know, it's super important right now because for some reason we like to keep changing our election laws every year. So these folks need to be up to date.
Mm-hmm.
But come to find out, not all of them are following the law. As a matter of fact, Fight Voter Fraud, I don't know if you've ever had them on the show. They're a nonprofit. They're located in Connecticut. They do all kinds of election integrity, and they do stuff out of state also. But they put together a report,
yeah.
of every single town, of every single registrar, and ask questions about, you know, are you certified? Can I see, you know, the documentation? Let me see documentation that you were trained.
Yeah.
And they're also responsible for canvassing. And what canvassing is, it's just to make sure, you know, dead people aren't on the voter rolls, or, you know, people that have moved out of state,
yeah.
that, you know, they're not on the voter rolls and managing the vote. And
mm-hmm.
it's something that's supposed to be done yearly. And they found out that not every town is fulfilling their statutory requirements. In fact, there's 110 registrars right now that aren't certified.
Wow.
About 60 of them, though, they have 2 years, so they're still under the wire, but there's 49 of them that literally are not certified and have not, through numerous FOIA requests, did not supply any documentation. And Fight Voter Fraud actually did compare the stuff they received through FOIA with the Secretary's of State's office. So
yeah.
Their data was, I spot checked a lot of their data, and it was dead on. And then another disturbing thing is there's so many of these towns, they're not even responding to FOIA requests at all. I think there was about, 71 towns that just literally would not respond, or they would send back pages that were all blacked out.
Yeah, that's my favorite. That's my personal favorite. When you get FOIA requests sent back, and every line has a big Sharpie drawn through it. Well, we gave you the pages.
Oh, it's so
right?
infuriating because you have to wait so long to get. I FOIA all the time.
Yeah.
I have some that are almost celebrating a birthday.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not trying to, take everything all out on these
mm-hmm.
registrars. And there's no consistency in the state.
Yeah.
Some towns, their registrars are part-time.
Yeah.
But they're working full-time hours. They're not even getting paid for it. So I'm not saying that all these registrars are these bad people out to break the law, but they are breaking the law. And, you know, Secretary of State needs to figure out what's going on. Is it the way they're, I mean, are they offering training virtually? I mean, are they using technology? I mean, why aren't they doing these? I mean, most people aren't going into this position to not follow the law.
Of course.
They're not doing it to break the law. But there's reasons why they're not getting certified. There's reasons why they're not able to comply with FOIA requests. And I think it's on the Secretary of State to sit there and talk to these people. What is it they need? I mean, I know in my town, you know, at budget meetings, you know, when they were rolling out this early voting, my city was crying, you know, we don't have enough money. Well, then why are we doing all of this?
Why are we doing this?
Why, if we can't support the people doing the job and we can't pay them, why are we doing it? And now, you know, we wanted to pass, you know, no excuse absentee ballot voting, you know, you're just going to add the burden on these people.
That's going to be just great. I can't wait for that, Megan. That's going to be just great. That's going to be just great. I can't wait for that. Can you?
Oh, and wait, and then they want this ranked choice voting, and I know where I stand on that. But if we can't handle voting like the one day, why are we doing like all this other nonsense?
Did you just say that you send FOIA requests out all the time?
Oh yeah, I send them. I'm not doing them to be burdensome.
No, because you have to.
You know, for news articles.
Yeah, no, you have to teach me how to do that because. You don't want to do it for burdening. I do. I just love to burden people. So would that be a cool thing? Someday we have to get together. You'll teach me how to do that. And they'll say, oh, it's this pain in the arse from WICC again. And I'll just keep sending him. How's that?
Sometimes I'm not going to name any names, but sometimes I think some of these towns can't even spell FOIA.
Oh, boy.
I'm like, dude, you gotta like respond to this stuff. And I'm not asking them to provide me or generate things that don't already exist. It's like documents that already exist. And it's like I can't get like the simplest things.
No, can't do that.
But I digress.
So folks, check it out, the Hartford Portfolio, Megan Portfolio, and find out if your city or town clerk has their proper certification. Megan, drive safely. Enjoy every calorie you consume this week, and we'll talk next week, okay?
Oh, I will. You too, Paul.
All right. There you go. Megan Portfolio, the Hartford Portfolio. She has to teach me that. All righty. Listen, if you're playing a drinking game and the key word for you to drink was tariffs, you were drunk a day and a half ago. So we'll see what happens with this. Welcoming back a gentleman we've had on from time to time, University of New Haven senior lecturer in economics and business, Dr. Brian Marks joins us here. Brian, it's Paul again on WICC. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. How are you on this rainy day of the week it is? Tuesday?
Yeah, I think it's Tuesday. Hold on. My computer says Tuesday anyway. Brian, good to have you back. So what is up here? First of all, explain the theory to my listeners, Brian, about tariffs, which are nothing new, but we'll get to how they may be used here. But what is the classic tariff and why is it used?
Well, historically, the U.S. government has put tariffs in initially to raise revenue, where I believe at one point 90% of U.S. government revenue came through tariffs. But after World War II, the world changed, globalization, and we were engaging in a period to facilitate trade. And the underlying outcome of all that was tariffs were then going to be used for national security reasons, or to protect a homegrown industry, and less about raising revenue, as well as addressing maybe unfair trade practices from another country. So that was the underlying premise behind tariffs. Unfortunately, there's a consequence. Like any public policy, the implication is tariffs result in a tax on goods that we import, and there are direct costs, that's the tariff amount directly, and we wind up with a tariff raising the price that consumers confront, which means there will be those consumers who are willing to buy at the world price, but now, since the price is higher, they reduce their quantity demanded and they're not buying as much as they did before. And those who are buying it at a higher price. on the flip side of all this,
yeah,
we have manufacturers who were not in the market, who have now re-entered the market because the price provided them an incentive to do so. So in economic parlance, we would say we have inefficiencies as a result of this tariff, resulting in what we call a deadweight loss, which means overall not something that's particularly good for consumers. Now, one thing I want to make perfectly clear to your listeners is often everyone says, well, let's start with President-elect Trump. He was quick to say the countries where we impose our tariffs, in this case now recently what he called out the other night, China, Canada, and Mexico, they'll pay for the tariffs. The other argument that's being made is consumers bear all of the tariffs. Legally, it's the importers who pay the tariffs. So we're talking about the legal incidents.
Okay.
But the economic incidents, it is substantially borne by the consumer, with some percentage borne by the seller, the exporter from the home country, those goods. So there is a little pain at the other end. It depends how important that good is to the people here in the United States. So if I'm very insensitive to price changes because I need that good, I'm going to bear more of the economic incidence of the burden of that tax. So that's the underlying premise and analysis behind tariffs.
And I guess, Brian, though, and the guest is Dr. Brian Marks from the University of New Haven on tariffs here. I guess, though, you very well laid out the nuts and bolts, the black and white of this, cash in, cash out of that. But then again, Brian, I guess there's the other angle to this is the why. Is this to be used for leverage? Is this 3D chess? Is this poker? You know, does Trump want more cooperation on immigration and or the drug cartels from Mexico? Is there a political mode in tariffs that ever works? And I know ever is a long time, but is it practical, do you think, or not?
Well, in the long run, I don't think it's practical. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
Our president-elect is very transaction-oriented. And he's looking at saying, I'm going to address an immigration issue. I'm going to address an illegal drug issue. He raised those same issues with China in the past when in Trump 1.0 administration. The net effect of all that is China did come to the bargaining table, agreed to something, but didn't follow through on everything that was on the table, even though they agreed. So if the past is now prologue, I'm not particularly confident that this negotiation tactic will be particularly effective. Now, let's consider this.
Sure.
He included Canada in the mix here. Is that realistic when everyone talks about where the issues are as far as the border? We never talk about the northern part of our border.
Yeah.
So arguably, it's calling for addressing a problem that may not exist north of the border. Now, let's go south of the border.
Okay.
The president of Mexico, she responded and said, we're already addressing these issues. And as a result, your call for these tariffs are unnecessary. And don't forget, we entered into a new agreement with the Trump 1.0 administration, a new trade agreement that deals and provides, quote, free trade, the easy flow of goods between Mexico, United States, and Canada. So when I look at this and when I look at the past, I'm not particularly optimistic unless he wants to claim, look, Mexico has said they've addressed the problem. Canada has addressed the problem. Everything's all good.
Yeah.
And incrementally, we're going to put another 10% on China when we factored all those tariffs in the first administration. It turned out to be harmful, based on many studies, to the U.S. economy, into the labor market, and to the pricing for consumers. So there is a concern.
Yeah. Yeah, and finally, Brian, I mean, I know a lot of people realize it, but a lot of people I don't think realize how interconnected we are, particularly on both sides of the border with Mexico and automobile manufacturing and also produce and vegetables as well, the importation and exportation of those.
Paul, you went exactly where I was going to go. So you're reading my mind, if you will. And you're exactly right. If we look at agricultural products, mm-hmm. and if we're worried about kitchen table items, a greater proportion of income will go to cover those tariffs for individual consumers. So price levels will rise.
Yeah.
So that's one of those things. Automobiles, getting parts. We talk about new cars. We need to talk about parts
yep. mm-hmm.
and the supply chain. And that will put more vehicles on the side or cause an increase in those price, which means the potential here with these tariffs is rising price levels, rising inflation, which we're already seeing concerns in the market in that if we look at the 10-year Treasury yields,
yeah.
they're up about, I believe, 4.4%, where before the election, we were hovering maybe around 4 or maybe even below that. And as a result, when we look at the Federal Reserve, so this goes to your interconnected part,
mm-hmm.
things are this is a complex economic system. And the Federal Reserve is due to meet, I believe, in the second week of December. What will the Fed do next with rates? We've mm-hmm. seen them reduce the rates twice. Chairman Powell is very thoughtful and considered, and very persuasive with his colleagues. We're already seeing the dot plots suggest, and that's sort of a prognostication tool that the Fed uses internally, to suggest that rates may not continue to decline as previously anticipated maybe 6, 8, 9 months ago, that rates may not go down. And in fact, there's a possibility that rates, in fact, may go up to address this inflationary impact.
Interesting. Great stuff. Brian, thank you. Dr. Brian Marks, University of New Haven. Brian, my biggest fear is that my scoop of guacamole at Chipotle is going to cost me a mortgage now. So let's watch that for us, okay? Can you do that?
Well, and we can certainly, and we'll be able to come back in next year in 2025 and look in the rearview mirror and see what happened to your price of guacamole.
We'll do the guac index. Brian, be good. Have a happy holidays, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
You too. Take care, Paul. Bye now.
Appreciate it right now. There you go. Dr. Brian Marks at the University of New Haven.